The Mashonah woman leaned over him and took one of her own tight, dark breasts in her hand, squeezing out the nipple between her fingers, and then she paused and looked up shyly, imploringly, at Robin. Only then did Robin understand, and respecting the privacy of woman and the poor maimed thing that had been her father, she dropped her eyes and turned away towards the entrance of the cave. "I must fetch my umuti. I will return here later tonight." Behind her, the childlike bleats gave way abruptly to small snuffling sounds of comfort. Robin felt no shock or outrage as she went down the steep pathway in the moonlight. Instead, she felt immense pity for Fuller Ballantyne, who had made the full circle back to infancy. She felt also a deep gratitude to the woman, and a sense of wonder at her loyalty and dedication. How long had she stayed on with Fuller Ballantyne after all reason for staying was gone? She remembered her own mother and her devotion to the same man. She remembered Sarah and her child still waiting patiently beside a far-off river. And then there was Robin herself, come so far and so determinedly. Fuller Ballantyne always had the power to attract as powerfully as he could repel. Holding Juba's hand for her own comfort as well as that of the child, Robin hurried along the moonlit path on the bank of the river, and with relief saw the glow of the campfires in the forest ahead of her. On the return journey, she would have bearers to carry her medical chest, and armed Hottentot musketeers as escort. Her relief was short-lived, for as she answered the challenge of the Hottentot sentry and entered the circle of firelight, a familiar figure rose from beside the campfire and came striding to meet her, tall and powerful, golden-bearded, and handsome as a god from Greek mythology, and every bit as wrathful. "Zuka," she gasped, "I didn't expect you." "No," he agreed icily, "I'm sure that you did not." "Why?" she thought desperately. "Why must he come now? Why not a day later, when I've had time to clean up and treat my father? Oh, God, why now? Zuka will never understand. Never, never, never." Robin and her escort could not hope to keep pace with Zuka. They fell swiftly behind him as he climbed the pathway in the night. Months of hard hunting had toned him to the peak of physical condition, and he ran at the hill. She had not been able to warn him. What words were there to describe the creature in the cave on the hilltop? She had told him simply, "I have found Pater." It had deflected his anger instantly. The bitter accusation shriveled on his tongue, and the realization dawned in his eyes. They had found Fuller Ballantyne. They had accomplished one of the three major objectives of the expedition. She knew that Zuka was already seeing it in print, almost composing the paragraph that would describe the moment, imagining the newspaper urchins shouting the headlines in the streets of London. For the first time in her life, she came close to hating her brother, and her voice was crisp as hoarfrost as she told him, "And don't you forget it was me. I was the one who made the march and broke trail. I was the one who found him." She saw the shift in his green eyes in the firelight. "Of course, Sissy," he smiled at her thinly, an obvious effort. "Who could ever forget that? Where is he? First I must assemble what I need." He had stayed with her until they reached the foot of the hill, and then had been unable to restrain himself. He had gone at the slope at a pace that none of them had been able to equal. Robin came out in the little clearing in front of the cave. Her heart was racing, and her breathing ragged from the climb, so that she had to pause and fight for breath, holding one hand to her breast. The fire in front of the cave had been built up to a fair blaze, but it left the depths of the cave in discreet shadow. Zuka stood in front of the fire, his back to the cave. As Robin regained her breath, she went forward. She saw that Zuga's face was deathly pale. In the firelight, his sun bronzing had faded to a muddy tone. He stood erect, as though on the parade ground, and he stared directly ahead of him. "Have you seen Pater?" Robin asked. His distress and utter confusion gave her a sneaking and spiteful pleasure. there is a native woman with him, Zuko whispered. In his bed. Yes, Robin nodded. He is very sick. She is caring for him. Why did you not warn me? That he is sick? She asked. That he had gone native. He's dying, Zuko. What are we going to tell the world? The truth, she suggested quietly, that he is sick and dying. You must never mention the woman. Zuga's voice, for the first time that she could remember, was uncertain. He seemed to be groping for words. We must protect the family. Then what must we tell about his disease, the disease that is killing him? Zuga's eyes flickered to her face. Malaria? The pox, Zuga. The French sickness. The Italian plague. Or, if you prefer it, syphilis, Zuga. He is dying of syphilis. Zuga flinched, and then he whispered. It's not possible. Why not, Zuga? She asked. He was a man, a great man, but a man nevertheless. She stepped past him. And now I have work to do. An hour later, when she looked for him again, Zuga had gone back down the hill to the camp beside the river pools. She remained to work over her father for the rest of that night and most of the following day. By the time she had bathed and cleaned him, shaved off the infested body hair, and trimmed the stringy beard and locks of yellowed hair, treated the ulcerations of his leg, she was exhausted both physically and emotionally. She had seen approaching death too many times not to recognize it now. She knew that all she could hope for was to give comfort and to smooth the lonely road that her father must travel. When she had done all that was possible, she covered him with a clean blanket and then tenderly caressed the short, soft hair which she had so lovingly trimmed. Fuller opened his eyes. They were a pale, empty shade of blue, like an African summer sky. The last sunlight of the day was washing the cave, and as Robin leaned over him, it sparkled in her hair in chips of ruby light. She saw something move in the empty eyes, a shadow of the man who had once been there, and Fuller's lips parted. Twice he tried to speak, and then he said one word, so husky and light that she missed it. Robin leaned closer to him. What is it? She asked.
Helen.
This time clearer. Robin felt the tears choke up her throat at the sound of her mother's name.
Helen.
Fuller said it for the last time, and then the flicker of comprehension in his eyes was gone. She stayed on beside him, but there was nothing more. That name had been the last link with reality, and now the link was broken. As the last light of the day faded, Robin lifted her eyes from her father's face, and for the first time realized that the tin chest was missing from the ledge at the back of the cave. Using the lid of his own writing case as a desk, screened from the camp by the thin wall of thatch, Zuga worked swiftly through the contents of the chest. His horror at the discovery of his father had long ago been submerged by the fascination of the treasures which the chest contained. The disgust, the shame, would return again when he had time to think about it, he knew that. He knew also that there would be hard decisions to make then, and that he would have to use all his force of personality and of brotherly superiority to control Robin and make her agree to a common version of the discovery of Fuller Ballantyne and a tactful description of the circumstances to which he had been reduced. The tin chest contained four leather and canvas-bound journals, each of 500 pages, and the pages were covered on both sides either with writing or with hand-drawn maps. There was also a bundle of loose sheets, 200 or 300 of them tied together with plaited bark string, and a cheap wooden pen case with a partition for spare nibs and cutouts for two ink bottles. One bottle was dry, and the pen nibs had obviously been sharpened many times, for they were almost worn away. Zuga sniffed the ink in the remaining bottle. It seemed to be an evil-smelling mixture of fat and soot and vegetable dyes that Fuller had concocted when his supplies of the manufactured item were exhausted. The last journal, and most of the loose pages, were written with this mixture, and they had faded and smeared, making the handwriting that much more difficult to decipher. For by this stage, Fuller Ballantyne's hand had deteriorated almost as much as his mind. Whereas the first two journals were written in the small, precise and familiar script, this slowly turned into a loose, sloping scrawl, as uncontrolled as some of the ideas expressed by it. The history of his father's madness was plotted therein with sickening fascination. The pages of the leather-bound journals were not numbered, and there were many gaps between the dates of one entry and the next, which made Zuger's work easier. He read swiftly, an art he had developed when acting as regimental intelligence officer with huge amounts of reading, reports, orders, and departmental manuals to get through each day. The first books of writing were ground that had been travelled before, meticulous observations of celestial position, of climate and altitude, backed up by shrewdly observed descriptions of terrain and population. Sandwiched between these were accusations and complaints about authority, whether it were the directors of the London Missionary Society or the Imperial Factor, as Fuller Ballantyne referred to the Foreign Secretary and his department in Whitehall. There were detailed explanations of his reasons for leaving Tet and travelling south with a minimally equipped expedition, and then quite suddenly two pages devoted to an account of a sexual liaison with an ex-slave girl, an Angoni girl whom Fuller had christened Sarah, and who he suspected was about to bear his child. His reasons for abandoning her at Tet were direct and without pretense. "I know that a woman, even a hardy native carrying a child, would delay me. As I am on God's work, I can brook no such check." Although what Zuger had seen on the hilltop should have conditioned him for this sort of revelation, still he could not bring himself to terms with it. Using his hunting knife, whetted to a razor edge, he slit the offending pages from the journal, and as he crumpled them and threw them in the fire, he muttered, "The old devil had no right to write this filth." Twice more he found sexual references, which he removed from the journal, and by then the handwriting was showing the first deterioration, and passages of great lucidity were followed by wild ravings and the dreams and imaginings of a diseased mind. More often Fuller referred to himself as the instrument of God's wrath, his blazing sword against the heathen and the ungodly, the weirdest and patently lunatic passages Zuger cut from the journal and burned. He knew he must work swiftly before Robin came down from the hilltop. He knew that what he was doing was right, for his father's memory and place in posterity, and also for those who would have to live on after him, Robin and Zuger himself, and their children and their children's children. It was a chilling experience to see his father's great love and compassion for the African people, and the very land itself changing and becoming a bitter, unreasoning hatred. Against the Matabele people, whom he referred to as the Indibele, or the Amandibele, he railed. "These leonine peoples who acknowledge no god at all, whose diet consists of the devil's brew and half-cooked meat, both in vast quantities, and whose greatest delight is spearing to death defenceless women and children, are ruled over by the most merciless despot since Caligula, the most grossly blood-besotted monster since Attila himself." Of the other tribes he was at least as scornful. "The Rozwis are a sly and secret people, the timid and treacherous descendants of the slave-trading and gold-mad kings they called the Mambos. Their dynasties destroyed by the marauding Indibele and their monstrous Nguni brothers, the Shanganans of Gungunda and the blood-smattered Angoni. The Karungas? Well, they were cowards and devil-worshippers, lurking in their caves and hilltop fortresses, committing unspeakable sacrilege and offending in the face of the Almighty by their blasphemous ceremonies in the ruined cities where once their Monomotapa held sway."